Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org.
Welcome back. This is Nancy Solomon filling in for Brian Lehrer, who's on vacation this week. Our next guest is a contributor to The New Yorker. Yesterday, he published an in-depth profile of New York City Transit Authority Chief Andy Byford, a British-born transplant who previously ran Toronto, Canada's mass transit. The profile dives into Byford's deep roots in public transportation, but also lays out the nuts and bolts of his near impossible task of turning around New York City's deteriorating subways. William, welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, delighted to be here.
So after your piece came out yesterday, The Times is now reporting that Mayor de Blasio finally met with the new New York City transit chief, is about to meet today. But so what do you make of this?
That was a sort of happy response. I mean, I was surprised to learn that de Blasio had never met with Byford, who's been in that job for 6 months, and said, you know, it's a bit weird not to hear from the mayor. Most places he's worked, Toronto, Sydney, London, I mean, the mayor's all over you if you're running mass transit, you know. Any deficiencies, they want taken care of right away. But New York's political structure is different around mass transit. And so I mentioned, you know, included that in my piece, and de Blasio's reaction when it came out was immediately to call Byford and say, let's have a meeting. So maybe that's going to change, and you're going to get the mayor actually behind mass transit much more than he has been.
It's a bit astounding that they hadn't met yet.
It's partly because the MTA, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which is in charge of mass transit in New York, is controlled by the governor. It's a long story, a long, you know, tangled history that's put the power there. But the mayor ends up feeling, and this would not be just de Blasio, but the mayor's, the city is paying a great deal into mass transit, and through fares, through taxes, through direct subsidies, and yet has sort of no representation. That is to say, it's the mayor's got control of a few seats on the board, but doesn't direct things the way the governor does.
Mr. Byford was on the Brian Lehrer Show earlier this year. Here's what he had to say about jobs.
Very large numbers of customers being moved about on ever-aging infrastructure, trains, signals, track, etc., and ever more crowded streets for the buses against a backdrop of limited funding. So that's effectively the triple whammy. But it's for me a dream. You know, any good transit professional worth their salt wants to have a crack at the real big jobs, and they don't get a lot bigger than this.
Yeah, I misspoke there. So that was obviously about his job, not jobs at the MTA. So why was Andy Byford chosen to lead the transit system?
Well, he was a pretty obvious choice if you're serious about modernizing. He did a pretty spectacular job by most accounts in Toronto, where he faced some of the same problems that he's facing here in New York, aging infrastructure, not much political support, very low morale among the troops. I mean, the system in Toronto is smaller than New York's, but it's not small. And he attacked that on all fronts and came forward with a very different attitude. He sort of put a face on the organization, you know, was a champion of it, and took all the arrows of complaint, which are, like New York, considerable, saying, I'm sorry, we'll do better. And manages to push through some major modernization programs and really pretty much revamp the place. I was surprised when I was first sort of traveling around with him in the system here one night, catching a ferry in Staten Island. A woman came up to us who said, "Do you know who this is?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "This man saved Toronto." And this is just, you know, some lady who spotted him. He was quite the celebrity and quite successful in Toronto. So last summer, I don't know if you remember the state of emergency, the summer of hell, all this stuff. And
of course.
And then the governor sort of stepped up and brought Joe Lota back as chairman of the MTA and told him, you know, go out and find a transit savior, somebody to run the subways and buses who can fix things. And so they might have interviewed a few people, but I think Byford was always the first choice.
How, going back through the history of the MTA, how different is it that to have someone who has this tremendous amount of experience with big city subway systems?
Yeah, in this job, it's not too common. His immediate predecessors were not people with, you know, transit operations backgrounds. But there was an earlier sort of collapse of the subways, even worse, even deeper than the sort of crisis we have now. This was in the 70s. When the trains were really, I mean, ridership was way, way down, like half what it had been after World War II, and the crime was such that people were actually scared to go on subways. And there was a kind of rebound then, you know, political leadership got serious, governors and mayors, and hired some top people to run MTA and NYC Transit, which is the largest part of MTA. David Gunn, Bob Kiley, Richard Ravitch, these are the characters who really turned it around and got good budgets for a change and really got serious about improving subways and succeeded. But that was into the 90s, let us say, and service greatly improved and safety and crime went way down. And then leaders have kind of cruised on that momentum ever since. And the breakdown really started in the last 10 years, where 10 years ago you had maybe 28,000 delays, I think it was, in per month. Now it's 70,000 and rising. The system wasn't invested in after that big investment in the 80s and early 90s.
What about the balance between, you know, on the one hand, going with a guy who's got this enormous experience and fixing other systems versus someone who's come up through the system here and has relationships and knows it and knows what the problems are deeply because they've been involved in it for so long? I mean, was that part of the equation? And could you get a sense of how hamstrung he's going to be as an outsider?
That's a great question because he says that all the mechanical challenges, the service challenges, the political challenges, are not as great as what he would call the cultural challenge, that is changing the culture of the MTA. Raising morale, getting people customer-oriented, as they say, and really believing they can do a better job. And that, I think the theory is that from the inside, that couldn't really be done, that there was no obvious person to take over and really make the whole place feel like it's under new management, which is his goal. I mean, from his very first MTA board meeting, which is a public monthly meeting, quite worth attending. It can be rowdy. It can be interesting. Public's allowed to comment. His very first one, he just had an attitude that stunned regular visitors to that meeting because he was sort of open and a group called Rise and Resist that advocates for people with disabilities, among other things, was, you know, protesting at that thing and presenting him with a map showing how inaccessible the subways were. And he was completely open to them and said, oh, great, you know, and gave a sort of upbeat speech and then went out with some activists to ride the subways and see what it looked like to them, which was all very much against what MTA culture had been up till then, which had been kind of hangdog and defensive. So he's really quite a breath of fresh air.
Is it also an issue of culture, or is it a problem entirely of a different sort? I loved the anecdote in your piece about the day that the ticket machines crashed throughout the whole system. So tell us that story, and then I'm kind of interested in, is that a culture thing, or is that a resource issue? Like, what was that problem?
Yeah, that was a sort of mixed thing. I happened to be with Byford and a couple of his aides and colleagues when they got word on a Friday evening that the MetroCard vending machines had crashed, all of them throughout the system. And so it was a bit of an emergency, and the police liaison happened to be there, Joe Nugent, and he immediately sent out a message to all cops throughout the system, don't arrest fare beaters, you know, they can't pay for their fares. And there was this, you know, scramble to fix it. And the IT people were kind of sheepish, and the guy they managed to reach said, only Miguel can fix this. He knows how to reboot the, you know, relevant sub-processor. And Byford, of course, was astounded. Miguel? Who is Miguel? Well, and where is Miguel? And this kind of dragged on as everybody looked for Miguel. It turns out he was driving upstate and, you know, out of range, wasn't answering his cell. And so the thing sort of dragged on. And then it turned out in the course of it that the New Jersey Transit had announced this problem hours before. I mean, the MTA was really looking bad. And it was all, you know, in search of one person, Miguel. And I had Byford muttering, "There will be a dozen Miguels up and running by Monday. You know, this system is really not ready." So that was more operational, but you could call it cultural as well. It was comic, and they got it fixed. But
I'm Nancy Solomon, managing editor for New Jersey Public Radio, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. If you're joining us, I'm speaking with William Finnegan on his profile of the new New York City Transit Chief, Andy Byford, which I misspoke slightly. It was published a week ago online and in paper today. Listeners, do you think the new leadership at the Transit Authority can drastically improve the subway system? What do you think needs to be done? And what are you willing to sacrifice for that? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Let's take a call. We've got Edward in Yorkville. Hi, Edward. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I read this piece with great interest, and it mentioned, I think, sort of briefly, his skills in terms of politics, the sheer politics. And it seems like here in New York, the real problem is Andrew Cuomo and Bill de Blasio, and their inability to cooperate on anything at all. In terms of funding and so on. And it sounds like he's a man who can get the job done under almost any other circumstance. I mean, I came away from the piece a tremendous fan of Andy Byford, but I am curious about that. Is there any way you can elaborate on what you know about his political skills?
Political skills. I'm not sure. A lot of that kind of is a chemistry that's a little bit invisible to me. I mean, he had never even spoken to de Blasio, as I mentioned, until, I guess, today. They're finally meeting. But he's had plenty of meetings with Cuomo, and I'm trying to get him on board now for his sort of big refurbishment plan. But as you mentioned, Cuomo and de Blasio, I've had this very bitter feud. I mean, quite childish, if I may say so, and kind of refused to work together, which is a great problem for Byford and for the city and the state generally. But there's also a kind of political structure around mass transit in New York that's highly dysfunctional. I mean, it's perennially, excuse me, underinvested. And that's, I would say, essentially because there's nobody really accountable. I mean, if you ask people in the subway when, you know, things are broken down, trains are stalled and so on, and these polls have been done a number of times, you know, who's responsible for this, do you think? Most people say, it's the mayor. And a certain number of people say, it's the governor. And with Cynthia Nixon's race for governor now pinning the subways on Cuomo, you hear, it's the governor more often. But basically, there's no single person accountable. And other cities, I described the situation in London at some length, where the tube, the London Underground, has come from a bad place to being one of the best mass transit systems in the world, working very, very well. There's a single point of accountability, which is the mayor of London. His main job is to make transportation work, and he's got generous budgets to do it. The sort of lack of political accountability in the New York system is, I'd say, the essential problem, and Byford understands that.
We have a caller that is very much involved in these sorts of debates and questions. John Raskin is the executive director of the Riders Alliance. John, we have you on the line. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm here.
You're quoted in the Times today saying that it doesn't matter a lot if de Blasio meets with Byford. Tell us why you think that.
Well, I think William's exactly right that the core issue facing public transit is one of accountability. You know, we've been saying since the summer of hell and this horrible year and longer that we've had on the transit system is that we need two things. We need a plan to fix the transit system, and we need the funding to make it possible. And now the governor brought in Andy Byford. Andy Byford created a plan. I think the plan is substantive and thoughtful, and he, as you know, William has been writing, Andy Byford comes with his own credibility. Now we need the other part, which is the funding. And so that's what actually today we and some of our colleagues in transit advocacy are laying out, our state-level agenda for the 2018 elections, for everyone running for governor and for state legislature. And the number one issue is make Andy Byford's plan a reality. What we're trying to do is cut through that lack of accountability that William is talking about and say, Governor Cuomo not only hired Andy Byford and runs the MTA, but he also dominates the state budget process that could actually create a funding source to make Andy Byford's plan possible.
So it sounds like you're pretty optimistic about Byford himself, that you're happy with so far his work and his appointment.
I think the stars are aligned for a real solution to the transit crisis. I think you have new leadership at the MTA that William wrote about, which is Andy Byford, and a bunch of new folks who are coming in, and folks who have been at the agency a long time who are really dedicated, who are being newly empowered to really be dynamic. I think that's in place. I think there's a recognition in the political system that the crisis is urgent and needs to be addressed. And the final piece we need is for the governor and members of the legislature to do their job and give the MTA the support it needs to fix the system.
Okay. Thanks so much. That was John Raskin, the executive director of the Riders Alliance. You know, yesterday we had a story, the WNYC newsroom had a story about air conditioning problems on the trains. And a reporter went out and talked to riders and came back with this piece of tape, which I loved.
It's like a bad appendage. If your leg is gangrenous, you amputate it. You take the damn car off, or you fix the thing. It's simple, and it makes people nuts. I mean, just talking to you right now, I'm infuriated just thinking of the ride back home.
What do you see as the top problems that are driving people crazy that need to be fixed?
Well, in the heat, cars that are un-air-conditioned are awful, of course. Although one should note that in the good old days, when the subway did work better, there was no air conditioning. That's a relatively recent, I mean, it was in that refurbishment of the 80s and 90s that we really got widespread, reliable air conditioning in the cars. I'd say the fundamental first problem is the signal system, which is very, very old. It's pretty safe. It's called fixed block. But it's the parts are just so old that signals are constantly breaking. Tracks are also in really bad shape, but that's a long-term, very expensive problem, resignaling. The more immediate stuff that can be done is more responsive operations to problems. You know, get an air conditioning. I mean, a car that's got malfunctioning air conditioning, get it off quickly, as this guy just said, and respond to problems quickly, and not with the kind of, you know, it's a public agency, we'll get around to it when we get around to it. That's the sort of mentality that Byford's really focused on changing. And we haven't talked about buses, but buses are also a big part of his job and a big part of Mass Transit in New York, and they've been in a really sort of bad decline, a sort of negative feedback loop of bad traffic and slower times and declining ridership and all that needs to be turned around. But it's operationally, a lot of it can be done. And in some ways, you know, getting down to the root causes of delays rather than saying, oh, overcrowding, which has been the main reason given for delays in recent years. Byford's eliminated that. No, overcrowding is not a root cause. You send more trains. Why can't we send more trains? Why is reliability down? And he's kind of drilling down into what are called dwell times, how long a train sits in the station, running times, of course, how quickly the trains go, and finding a lot of problems there. So there are many places to attack.
I think one of the places to attack is on the list of our next caller, Karina in Queens. You're on the air. Hi, Karina.
Hi, good morning. I am really frustrated. I take the J train a lot to work, and I've been through the summer of hell with the J train and the M train, you know, under the construction and stuff like that. And I really don't think that the MTA is doing a very good job outreaching to the communities in Queens that rely on the J train. And they're really only doing outreach in, like, they were in maybe a Ridgewood or Bushwick along the border in Queens, but they need an outreach to the communities that are along the J line, like in Woodhaven and Richmond Hill and Jamaica, because we're the ones that are going to be impacted the most by this L train shutdown. And I don't really think they're addressing our concerns about overcrowding and trains not, you know, are they going to come frequently? Because otherwise people are going to get late to work.
Yeah, there's this L train shutdown that you mentioned is coming April 2019 for 15 months. And that's not in Brooklyn, but from Brooklyn to Manhattan. And in Manhattan, you know, that sort of crucial jump over to 14th Street from Bedford Avenue, the last stop in Williamsburg. And it's true that something like 225,000 people daily are going to be stranded and have to, I mean, the J train is going to be very heavily affected. They're going to be a big mitigation plan. You know, they've been running 70 new buses an hour over the Williamsburg Bridge. They're going to close 14th Street in Manhattan to cars and trucks. It's just going to be buses and bikes. And, of course, there are lawsuits being filed by community groups in Manhattan against the plan. But I think it will go forward, and it is going to definitely crowd up the J, the Z, I think, the M. It's going to be a not perhaps a dress rehearsal exactly, but I mean, if the big resignaling plan that Byford is proposing goes on, there are going to be a lot of shutdowns of service, not, you know, just nights and weekends, but a lot more than we've had. But this L train shutdown, which is necessary, I should mention, because the Canarsie tube, that is the part of the L train that goes under the East River, was heavily damaged by Hurricane Sandy, and they did some sort of temporary patches, but they really need to close it and do it right, and that's going to take 15 months. So you are looking at some real inconvenience and crowding starting next April.
You talked earlier about Andy Byford trying to create a culture change within the MTA. Let's take another call because we have Matt in Harlem who would like to talk about a different kind of cultural change as far as the subways go. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi. I've ridden the train in Tokyo and Harlem, in Hong Kong, Paris, London, a lot of different places. And what always strikes me about New York is how eager we are to litter and spread debris around and sleep on the platforms and basically be grubby and terrible. And it falls to, you know, a lot of our problems with delays have to do with a sick passenger or, you know, the trains, the tracks catching fire because there's litter everywhere. Is there any push to change our horrible culture as far as mass transit? They don't even push each other on the trains in Tokyo, which is supposed to be quite famous for pushing. It doesn't happen, really.
Is this something that you discussed at all with Andy Byford?
Yeah, and there's a nice, vivid description of how we behave in the trains. Yes, I mean, they've got some new vacuum trains that they're just deploying now, which are going to suck up the garbage in the roadbed and thereby reduce fires and perhaps even rats. There are, as you say, kind of low standards for littering and the rest of it throughout the system. And Byford seems quite focused on that, mainly through station agents, that is the people who work on the platforms and in the old toll booths. And he's got a new system he's proposing called Group Station Managers, where there's going to be a single point of accountability for the cleanliness and the general performance of stations. There'll be somebody to go to. That person's picture will be posted, their email, if the station's in bad shape, it's on this person. And that's worked quite well in London, I guess, and he's very enthusiastic about it. He says this is going to really make a difference, you know, facing the customers with conditions and a sort of responsibility for those. But as for New Yorkers changing and not being such slobs, as you put it, that's maybe beyond his brief. And as is homelessness. I mean, especially in the wintertime, an awful lot of people head for the subways because they're warm and certain trains are warm. And that's beyond any subway manager's ability to affect.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, Bill. William Finnegan is a contributor to the New Yorker magazine. His new piece is Can Andy Byford Save the Subways? Thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Welcome back to The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Joan Walsh, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. The nomination of originalist Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court has energized Governor Cuomo to call for the New York Senate to come back to Albany and take up the Reproductive Health Act, or RHA, that would codify Roe v. Wade into state law. Listen to what he had to say.
I want them to come up and pass it. And if they don't come up and pass it, then the voters are going to know they're against it. And there's power in that clarity.
To talk about what happens, at least here in New York, should Roe be further eroded or even overturned, and to talk about the renewed interest in the RHA, I'm happy to be joined by its sponsor in the state Senate, Liz Krueger, from the Upper East Side 28th Senate District, and by Alexis Grinnell, who's a co-founder of Pythia Public, a political and public affairs firm, and a frequent contributor to the New York Daily News. Welcome back to the show, Senator Krueger and Alexis.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joan.
Senator Krueger, people forget that New York current law on abortion rights predates Roe v. Wade. At some point, it was considered progressive. At another point, not so much. But it hasn't mattered because Roe was more expansive, right?
Pretty much. It's true. We passed a law in 1970, 3 years before the Roe v. Wade decision. And at the time, it was not just progressive, it was radical. It was the first state in the nation to pass a recognition of abortion rights. But over those decades and decades and decades, as the world has changed, law has changed, science has changed for pregnant women, what we have learned is that, in fact, our law is incredibly unsatisfactory to address women's rights to reproductive health. And we've just sort of functioned in New York like, well, we have Roe v. Wade. So the fact that we don't actually have good law on our books probably doesn't matter that much, although it does matter very much to a certain sub-universe of people who find themselves needing, for health and life purposes, to have a third-term abortion. And then they learn you really can't get one here in New York State because of our law. And they have to travel states away, spend thousands of dollars, and in a couple of recent cases, didn't get there in time and ended up dying. So yes, we've always needed to modernize and make scientific our law in New York State. And we have flunked that test. But now, because of the potential change in the Supreme Court, it's not a if, it's a when do we have to do this. And we have to do this.
So let me walk our listeners through what the RHA would do beyond codify Roe v. Wade, which is a little bit abstract. As I understand it, there are three main components. It would take abortion from the criminal code to public health law. What does that mean?
Well, in New York State, we don't actually recognize abortion as a healthcare medical procedure. It's the only one. We have it in the criminal code that
wow.
If you are choosing to have an abortion in the following circumstances, it's not a crime. That's all we say about it in New York State law. Well, imagine if we were discussing insurance and care for a
vasectomy.
Heart attack, vasectomy, anything in healthcare, dental work within the criminal code. You just sort of stop and go, well, that doesn't make sense.
Yes, you do. As you already referenced, it would decriminalize late-term abortions. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So the fact is that over 50 years now, science has really changed, and doctors, through testing and scanning, can evaluate into much later in pregnancies whether there are viability problems, whether that fetus is not going to actually survive the birth process, whether in fact the mother, his life is at risk if they continue the pregnancy through completion, even though they recognize that it's not a viable fetus. We didn't have the science to even know that years and years ago. Sure. So now doctors are saying to patients, you know, bad news, we've done the scans, we've done the tests, this is not a viable fetus, it's not going to be born and live. And or our evaluation is your life is at risk if you continue this pregnancy, even though it is very late in the process, perhaps your eighth month, and you are desperately attached to being able to complete this pregnancy and you were hoping for a healthy baby.
Right.
So they tell women this, and it's tragic, and there's a million variations of the medical technicalities. And then they say, really, what is in your best interest is a surgical abortion. Unfortunately, we don't do them here in New York this late in pregnancy. And they refer them to three states and only a handful of doctors who will actually provide these services. And I have talked to women who have lived through the experience of being told, you have to find the money to fly yourself out to Colorado, insurance isn't going to pay for this, you have to go through this, and you have to do it now. And it's the most traumatic thing most of us could imagine having to go through. And they go, how can I not get this in New York? I'm in New York City, center of
progressivism and health.
But also I joke that I represent Bedpan Alley. Every major hospital in the country is on the east side of Manhattan. And there's not one who will provide these services because they say, given New York state law, they believe they face liability of some district attorney filing criminal charges against them.
And finally, I believe your bill would let non-physicians provide medical abortions as in the pill form. And I confess I don't know the status of access to abortion pills in the state right now.
Well, so again, science has moved forward. And most abortions are in fact done early on in a very non-invasive way. Pills is one of the formats. And truthfully, in New York State already, non-doctors, but who are recognized through scope of practice to be medical experts, are providing these kinds of early abortions. So under an AG's decision and health and education regulations, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, and midwives can, within their scope of practice, do early non-surgical, non-hospital-based abortions. This would just put it into law to make it clear once and for all. But in fact, many other states already have this in their law.
Right.
And on a daily basis, this is operational and standard practice in New York.
We'd love to take a call or two for Senator Krueger and Alexis Grinnell. Let us know if you have a question about New York's RHA, New York law, abortion laws generally. Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Alexis, I want to bring you in here. I think a lot of people here and across the country really do assume that New York, like California, would have strong abortion rights. I am from New York, but I lived in California for 30 years. And I know, I think it's the only state that is actually in the last 10 kind of dark, tough years actually strengthened abortion rights. But when we compare these two big blue states, what are we missing? Are we forgetting about upstate New York? Why has New York lagged?
Well, so that's a great question, Joan, and so much of it actually has to do with our very non-progressive politics. In fact, there's a misnomer that this is a progressive state, that we're leading the nation in all sorts of ways, and that's really a lot of rhetoric. When you get down to the reality, we see these gaping holes. So 4 years ago, the Women's Equality Agenda, which included the Reproductive Health Act as the 10-point, as part of a 10-point plan, came before the legislature and got stuck in the Senate. And this is where it died. And then incidentally, the governor invented a sham party called the Women's Equality Party, nominally to help get the 10th plank of the Women's Equality Agenda to pass the Reproductive Health Act itself. And, you know, he ran around the state in a pink bus and talking about quote unquote women's issues, which is, you know, of course, an absurd concept since abortion is not a women's issue. It's a public health issue, social issue, it's an economic issue, it's all of our issues. And then he got reelected with the Women's Equality Party. And basically, nobody talked about the Reproductive Health Act ever again, except for people like Senator Liz Krueger and a small group of very engaged, very concerned people. Because like the senator said, we've been relying on the federal backstop that is Roe v. Wade, now under threat. So here we are now, fast forward 4 years. And the governor, all of a sudden, leaping to attention, says, okay, they got to go back and do it. They got to go back and do it. When in fact, of course, it is because that the Senate has been in control, controlled by a sort of a gruesome alliance between previously identified Democrats or Democrats previously identified as the Independent Democratic Conference and Republicans who've kept the RHA from the floor. Now, whereas sometimes the governor and others like to say this is a problem in the Senate, of course, when it was time to dissolve that arrangement, the governor was the one to do it. So it really begs one to question whether or not we needed to have this unholy alliance for so long, keeping women's reproductive rights on the back burner, if it was so easily dissolved at the governor's sort of snap of his fingers. And it also raises another question, which is, you know, another pushback we sometimes hear is that, well, even if the Democrats have been in charge, the Democratic Conference wasn't 100% pro-choice. Well, in fact, we know that there are Republicans who are pro-choice, just like with the marriage equality issue. When we actually brought over Republicans to vote on the issue when it came to the floor, because the governor put every ounce of political capital into making that deal happen and making New York a major leading state to pass marriage equality, which was a huge coup. Ooh. So somehow he was able to do that, and the Senate was not an obstacle. Yet when it comes to women's reproductive health, all of a sudden it's blame the Senate. That doesn't make any sense. And it really indicates the political problem we have in this state when it comes to passing progressive policies. And that lies solely with the arrangement that gubernatorial candidate Cynthia Nixon, I know, has been pointing out loud and proud.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up. I know Cynthia Nixon has, been strong on this issue. Was at a rally yesterday, I believe, and she has held Cuomo personally accountable for not acting the way you've described.
And she's right. And the problem is, New Yorkers are overwhelmingly pro-choice, and Democrats are overwhelmingly pro-choice. You cannot get elected to statewide office in New York without being pro-choice. So it's a great issue for the governor to run on. Actually, doing something about it might be another matter, but it's something that, you know, even right after Trump was elected in 2017, Planned Parenthood had their lobby day up in Albany. Cecile Richards was in town. It was a sea of women coming up to lobby and wearing pink pussy hats from the Women's March. It was amazing. The governor got up and talked about how pro-choice he was, and then he said he was going to introduce a constitutional amendment to enshrine and codify Roe into New York state law. That sounds good, except a constitutional amendment is about 1,000 times harder to pass than the Reproductive Health Act alone.
Exactly.
And Senator Krueger at the time said, you know, great, that's really not what we want or what we need, because technically you have to pass something to be in the Constitution has to pass two consecutive sessions of the legislature, then go to the ballot for a public referendum before it can even be enshrined. Passing a bill, you just have to do once in the legislature by taking a vote. So if you can't simply get it past the legislature, introducing a constitutional amendment is nonsense and meaningless. But it's a great campaign issue. It sounds good to say, and people love to, point to it as a proof of some sort of feminist bona fide.
Yes. I want to bring Senator Krueger back in. Do you sign off on this history much the way Alexis tells it?
Yes, I do agree with Alexis's history. You know, the one place I would point out is the governor saying we should go back to vote for the RHA now. That won't happen. And I think the public gets confused that if he just orders us back, we have to take the vote. I would love that, but in fact the problem, and it's exactly the history Alexis described, is that Senate Republicans control whether a bill comes to the floor or not for a vote, even if they have members who support it. So since John Flanagan remains the majority leader, he's very clear that he is not bringing this bill to the floor. And in fact, in response to the governor the last couple of days getting focused again on it, the Republicans have been saying some truly outrageous things about my bill, leading me to know they have no intention of changing their position. We need more Democrats in the Senate. Technically, we left session at the end of June in a 31-31 tie, in a very strange storyline.
Right.
We have elections in November. We get a Democratic majority in January. We have a new majority leader. I believe it would be Andrea Stewart-Cousin for the Democrats.
Yes.
That my
a
bill,
woman.
A woman, who's the number two sponsor of the Reproductive Health Act. I believe that bill would come to the floor for a vote, and it would pass.
So I am Joan Walsh of The Nation and CNN, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with New York State Senator Liz Krueger, who represents the 28th District on the Upper East Side. All those hospitals up there, as she points out. She's the Senate sponsor of the Reproductive Health Act. And I'm also talking with Alexis Grinnell, co-founder of Pythia Public, a political and public affairs firm, and a frequent contributor to the New York Daily News. But I want to go to a caller. We have a lot of callers. I'd love to go to Garen in Brooklyn. Garen, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Garen. Can you tell us a little bit about your story?
Yes. A couple of years ago, my wife and I had to leave the state and fly to Colorado to end a non-viable pregnancy when we found out at 30 weeks that the baby wouldn't be able to breathe outside the womb. And, you know, we, of course, like many New Yorkers, were surprised to find out about the New York state law. We had to fly at 32 weeks for an abortion. And since then have been working, and we've, you know, shared our story with Senator Krueger, and we've been working to try and help get the RHA passed. We've also met a number of people across the state who've gone through similar circumstances, and I think it's just important for people to understand that this law and the current state law really does affect people. And we really do need the passage of the RHA so that this doesn't continue to happen year after year. It's not a political football. It affects people's lives.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. Sure, I know that stories like that are really important and they shock people. Senator Krueger, do you want to respond?
Well, I've gotten to know Garen and his wife, Erica, quite well over the last few years, and they are really heroes and heroines of the story. Highlighting and being willing to tell their tragic story to legislators and anyone who is prepared to listen. And they speak eloquently about how our antiquated law actually are putting women's lives at risk. And they have brought other people into the discussion, other people who have been now willing to talk about their experience and what happened to them, thanks to Erica and Garen's willingness to bring forward their story. They also have successfully had a beautiful baby after that experience.
Terrific.
Pepper, who comes around and, as far as I'm concerned, is the most joyous baby I've ever met. So I always love seeing Erica and Garen, especially if they bring Pepper along with them.
All right. One of these days we'll meet Pepper, too. I'm going to take another call from Devorah in Brooklyn. Hi, Devorah.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Senator Luker. So I'm really so happy that you're discussing this. I was hired in 2012 just for a few months to gather stories of women and couples who had to leave the state to get later term abortions to help pass the Reproductive Health Act. And what I found was that many, many women who needed later term abortions did not fit, you know, the story of the tragic, you know, where the fetus has a viability problem, or the woman has a, you know, serious health problem because of the pregnancy, although there are those stories and they're hugely tragic and very important. But many also have very different stories. Like, there are young women who are raped by family members and don't know that they're pregnant until later on, until it's too late to get the legal abortion. There are women who get pregnant when they're on birth control and can't possibly have children. They just cannot. They're unwanted pregnancies, and they just didn't know that they were pregnant. There are so many different stories about why women need later term abortions. Some women couldn't afford to get an abortion. They're panicking, they're scrambling, trying to gather funds. And so I understand that the need for the story of that everyone can get behind, and that's clearly tragic and you can't get around it. But I really think that we need to wrest the narrative away from what it is at this political time, particularly now, because you know, abortion is an ethical, moral issue. I interviewed abortion doctors who did their work because they saw how their mothers had to have multiple kids and how it ruined their health and everyone's life. And I think that we need to bring out the ethics from our vantage point and how it isn't easy to bring a child into today's world. We don't have resources to take care of children the way we need. And look at the hypocrisy. Everybody understands this hypocrisy about wresting children away from their parents and making them completely traumatized and, you know, being pro-life. It just, so I really think that we need to educate the public a bit better instead of like focusing on that one very tragic story, which is very real
right.
and very important.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that. Alexis, I want to just bring you back in here. We're getting close to needing to close, but I wanted to let you respond to that.
Yeah, I'm so glad, Devorah, for your call. And I could not agree more with you. And frankly, abortion is a human right. These stories are obviously, as you put it, you know, sort of sympathetic and the sort of story that most people can get behind, but it's not the whole story. And the fact is, the, you know, attacks on abortion rights by the federal government at the state level are really an attack on women's lives and their, you know, right to govern their own bodies and make decisions about what direction they want in their lives at that time. And that's it. And frankly, there's a lot of discussion about healthcare, which is relevant and absolutely central. And there's a lot of discussion about economics, which is also relevant and absolutely central. But at some foundational level, this is just about whether or not a woman, like any other person, is entitled to run her life, control her body, and make decisions for herself. And so, as Senator Krueger pointed out, there's a lot of misinformation flying around that Senate Republicans right now are seeding the ground with to use scare tactics and fearmonger. But all that is a smokescreen for the fact that they don't think a woman should have the right to make that kind of decision about her body and what she wants to do with it. And a few months ago, I actually wrote in one of my columns about my parents who had an abortion 3 years before the Roe v. Wade passed. They had it in New York, and it was because my mother's IUD had failed. She was on birth control. She was married. And they were just too poor and not in a place in their lives where they were able to have a child. And so they had an abortion that is a part of was fundamental to their own ability to plan their lives and have the one that eventually brought me 13 years later into the world. So plain and simple, this is a human rights issue.
Senator Krueger, I want to close with maybe some optimism. Are you feeling optimistic that we're going to have action on the RHA? I mean, it probably will take till January. Tell us what you're thinking.
So I have sadness and optimism.
Okay, I'll take both.
Okay, so the sadness is the discussion that Devorah and Alexis and you and I have been having this morning is exactly the discussion people were having in this country before Roe v. Wade.
Right.
And the tragedies and the realities for women were horrifying, and the number of women who died and in back alley abortions and destroyed their bodies trying to end a pregnancy that was unwanted was mind-boggling, and it woke people up. And so we did get Roe v. Wade, and now we're living through a moment in history where I'm pretty convinced we will have a Supreme Court that are going to take those rights away from us. So I am sad and angry. At the same time, states will realize we're up. The only line left in the sand for protecting our citizens are good state laws, the right state laws. So I am sure that due to the dangerous, dangerous actions in Washington, New York State will pass a Reproductive Health Act because people will recognize we need the right law. We need to codify the rights that are in Roe v. Wade that we actually haven't really had here in New York. since 1970. Right. We need to put those in our law. And I think you'll see states all over the country following our lead or being in front of us and making sure they have the right laws at home.
So that is, it gets me to end on my one of my favorite hobby horses, which is we really need to be paying attention, Democrats, progressives, liberals, to the state legislatures, because so much terrible stuff has happened there and so much progressive stuff can happen there. And a lot of people check out when it comes to those elections. So definitely vote at every level, all of you, whatever way you want. So I'm going to leave it there. This has been a great discussion. Thank you, New York Senator Liz Krueger and Alexis Grinnell. Thank you both. Glad to meet you. Talk to you again.
In the last several weeks, the Trump administration's separation of some 3,000 immigrant children from their parents at the border has propelled cries of moral outrage and calls for family reunification. In the eyes of many, the policies represent a betrayal of American values. But if you examine the history of the Latino experience near the U.S.-Mexico border, you'll find even more horrific precursors of racially charged violence. That's what our guests today have been doing. Here to talk about border history and provide some context for what's happening today are journalist Michelle Garcia and Monica Munoz Martinez, professor of American and Ethnic Studies at Brown University. Michelle, Monica, I welcome you both to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So, Michelle, you recently published an article in The Baffler called "The Border and the American Imagination." You're making the argument that words such as zero tolerance and immigration crisis are proxies for discrimination against Mexicans that's been happening for generations. And you say that, quote, "the weeping children on the border are the latest casualties in a pattern of racial violence that began in the 19th century." Start us off there. Describe this period.
Sure. So you have In the 19th century in Texas, before the formation of the border as we know it now, you had incoming newcomers to the territory, whites from the southern states, slave-owning states, states where the Indian Removal Act had occurred, coming in, making contact with Tejanos, Mexicans living here, and they're deemed a mongrel race, racially inferior, abomination, because of the intermingling between European blood and native blood. And from that moment forward, Mexicans, Mexican-Americans, were viewed by many as racially inferior. And from that came a policy, a history of violence, of subjugation, Jim Crow, and that became culturally entrenched, so much so that it almost goes unquestioned. And in many ways, largely, has contributed to the crisis that we see on the border, a crisis that is described as an immigration crisis, as if the presence of the immigrants provokes this violence. What I do in the piece is look at the violence that exists and persists, waiting for the next opportunity to express itself, as we have seen recently.
Monica, you are the founder of an organization called Refusing to Forget and the principal investigator of the Mapping Violence Online Project. You also have a forthcoming book about this history. Tell us about these efforts. What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, thanks. And I'm so happy to be with you today and also to be joining Michelle, who's just done incredible work in her journalism to share this longer history of violence and the creation of the border. I'm a historian of racial violence in the early 20th century, and I primarily study immigration and policing histories. But I also recognize that violence and injustice don't stay in the past. Unacknowledged injustice impacts entire communities for generations. And so my book examines a stark period of state terror on the U.S.-Mexico border 100 years ago. But I've been working with my colleagues in Refusing to Forget to commemorate this period of violence, because most most people don't know that this happened. And so we're working to try to commemorate this period. But, you know, these efforts are happening in the midst of another humanitarian crisis on the border, which really compels our efforts to make these histories public, because America really has a problem with righting our wrongs because we choose to forget these histories of violence, or worse, we whitewash them in our understandings of the past. So this is some of what Michelle is speaking to, the fact that, you know, the history of Indian removal in 1830 and the American war of aggression with Mexico that, you know, resulted in the United States acquiring half of Mexico, that those are remembered in the United States as progress, right, as opposed to histories of colonization and histories of genocide and violence. And as a result, we still are learning how to interpret. You know, many people are looking to the past to figure out how we got to this point and to this crisis.
So what do you mean by commemorate, Monica? How are you trying to commemorate some of these points in history?
Well, we've worked actively with state cultural institutions. So our first sort of major event was an exhibit at the Texas State History Museum here in Austin, the Bullock Museum. And the exhibit was called Life and Death on the Border from 1910 to 1920. And it documented this period, this decade of brutal violence in which hundreds, if not thousands, of ethnic Mexicans, some were Mexican nationals and many were American citizens, were targets of violence at the hands of the Texas Ranger, the state police force, U.S. soldiers, and Anglo vigilantes. And so this museum was the first time that the state of Texas was acknowledging this period of violence, but also acknowledging the role of Texas governors, of the Texas State Ranger Force in calling for violence. But it also recovered an important history of resistance, the stories of people like Jovita Hidad, Texas State Representative Jose Ticanales. You know, these were active citizens who protested the violence and asked for change. So, you know, working with state cultural institutions like the Bullock Museum, we're also working with the Texas Historical Commission to have historical marker unveilings in South Texas. So we unveiled one in Cameron County to commemorate a peak of violence in 1915. We'll also be having another unveiling in El Paso to commemorate the Porvenir Massacre, which was an act of brutality that occurred in 1918 and really raised public concern about the escalating violence.
Can you describe that a little bit for us?
Yeah, so, you know, the Porvenir Massacre is this really heartbreaking and gut-wrenching story of a ranching community in West Texas. In January 1918, a Company B of the Texas Rangers called on the U.S. cavalry that were local in the area to visit this ranching community in the middle of the night on January 28, 1918. They separated the men some young boys from the women and younger children and elderly men. And that night they massacred these unarmed men and boys. So in total, 15 were murdered that night. And what it led to was actually this long history of generations of these descendants of that massacre seeking justice for the events, the tragedies that occurred that night.
So, Michelle, when we talk about how Donald Trump ascended to the presidency, it's nearly always in the same breath as a discussion of anti-immigrant rhetoric. So his language describing immigrants is often construed in terms of criminality or something less than, quote unquote, you know, real Americans. What are some of the precursors, both overt and subtle, to this rhetoric?
Well, I've written a number of pieces saying that what Donald Trump has done in both rhetoric and in policy has built on his predecessors. In the rhetoric about animals or immigrants or Latinos as infesting or in some way less than human, that was occurring in Texas with the man who's now lieutenant governor, ran on that, saying that immigrants bring third world diseases. So we have the media representation of immigrants as criminals. More than half of representations of Mexican Latino immigrants is that of criminals. We also have this over time through cultural representation, journalism, history, historical renditions, has, and then of course policy and political rhetoric, has created in the public imagination an image of Latinos, as Mexican Americans, as the perennial foreigner, as dangerous, and never really American. So there's a number of players and actors that he has drawn from. And what I write is that he's not an aberration, he's the culmination.
And you can sort of see this in a very, you know, I know that on the streets of New York City, I often get asked where I'm from, and I'm sure that you guys probably get that question as well, which I don't really take offense to, but it does beg the question, are people assuming that I am not American and from here?
Well, I think that from the beginning, the United States talks about race largely as black and white. So when you have Latinos and a history that's different from an East Coast history, one that's also very rooted in the frontier, that border and the frontier and immigration becomes the proxy for discussions of Latinos with a racialization. And so if we think about, for example, in New York, Irish as being part of the fabric and the identity of New York City, right? As almost default American, right? But when it comes to Latinos, citizenship has always, from the beginning historically, been questioned about whether to extend citizenship to Mexicans who were living in the territory of Texas at the end of the U.S.-Mexico War, whether Mexican-Americans, were racially unfit. That was the argument, to actually become U.S. citizens. And so what we have and what we experience now is the where are you from, how long have you been here, because you could not have already been three or four generations. And as if the people who are asking the question are entitled to the mantle of Americans in a way that Latinos are not.
Listeners, what questions do you have for our guests about the historical precursors to the border crisis? What questions do you have about the experience of Mexican Americans in Texas? How have you arrived at your own reckoning with the history of racial violence in this country? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Monica, how has uncovering the history of racial violence towards Mexicans and Mexican Americans in the U.S. informed how you understand the current marginalization and segregation of Latinos within modern American society?
Well, Cindy, there are striking parallels, unfortunately. You know, what Michelle was gesturing to in thinking about the political rhetoric that is resurging, you know, this sort of anti-immigrant sentiment that has become a political talking point for some campaigns, you know, really gained momentum in the 1990s and has continued until today. And so that's one thing that, you know, today we're talking about cartel members and gangsters, and 100 years ago, you know, any Mexican was assumed to be a bandit or a revolutionary. And so that kind of criminalizing people leads to violence. And when the public buys into that sentiment, it also creates a culture of impunity, so that, you know, the policing, the violent policing, the murder or the detentions of people, for the most part, go unanswered by humanitarian calls. And so, you know, for decades, centers like Colibri, the Center for Human Rights, has been calling attention to the thousands of people that are dying trying to cross into the border and into the country. And, you know, that is because of deterrence policy that was implemented into the 1990s. But it finally took children, you know, crying in cages to raise public awareness. And so, you know, part of what the history teaches us is that we have to look at the systemic patterns that create these conditions, and we have to avoid falling into these traps by politicians that criminalize people, that call them, that make us fearful of immigrants and refugees, and that results in the denial of due process, a culture of impunity for excessive force and abuse by detention centers or by officers, but that also that we have to turn to this longer history of agents that have made social change. And so some of the hard work and the harrowing work that I hear from, you know, immigration attorneys, advocates, is there's a long history of Americans who have fought for social justice, and that is a part of our legacy that, that Americans are really tapping into right now to demand change.
Cindy, so, if I can just add one thing to that, which is, you know, I've been covering, and from the beginning of my career, immigration in some form, beginning with the effects of 1996 immigration reform under Bill Clinton. And it has been cyclical, where there would be new legislation, an outcry, some coverage. In 96, it was laws targeting green card holders and making crimes, petty crimes, that they had committed years, decades prior, suddenly deportable crimes. And I would track these stories over and over again. And what I came to realize is why, and I began to question and change the direction of my work, is why does the border and this image can possess so much political currency, social currency in our country that is unlike other people, unlike other immigrants, so much so that it doesn't matter whether immigration, illegal border crossings is up or down. People are calling for border security. After 9/11, you had the creation of the border wall. So what I feel like we're talking about is the perception and the policy of this country that insists on a violent expression on the frontier.
Michelle, let's take a call from Michaela in Trenton, New Jersey. Michaela, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Go
can
ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear
sorry.
You. That's all right.
Yeah, I guess my comment, so I live in Trenton right now, but I was raised in Houston, just southeast in a suburb. And in Texas public school, we take 2 years of Texas history. And it wasn't really until this call when I was listening in during my lunch break that I heard of any of the events that you and your guests have been describing. And like I myself personally have been to the border. We went every Thanksgiving with our church. And my mom, she is of Mexican descent, but she was adopted. And even in her own adoption, we never really thought that much of it. We always thought, like, to us, like in Texas, we think of it as like a very like welcoming place, at least in my area, because like in anyone's family, you can kind of like find someone who is of Hispanic descent. But it wasn't really until listening to the story and also listening to Latino USA that I've heard of these kind of horrific events that occurred in a place that I called home for until I went to college and moved up to the East Coast.
Michaela, thank you so much for that comment. Michelle, Monica, why don't we know more of this history?
That's a great question, and it's one that I explore at length in my book. And, you know, one part of it comes back into the way that history is crafted and remembered. You know, there is a hero myth of the Texas Rangers that looms large in Texas. And so, you know, for most Texans, they say they're unsettled when they hear this history. And, you know, this decade was an atrocious period of violence. But the roots of the Texas Rangers, you know, were violent as well. They participated in Native genocide. They participated in capturing, you know, people who were trying to escape slavery, who were traveling through Texas to reach Mexico. And, you know, in the 19-teens, the violence was only expanded in part because of the militarization of the border. You also had U.S. soldiers who were training for World War I, and so they were using new military technologies on the border. And it's also important to note here that it's not just immigrants or Mexican refugees that were coming into the United States fleeing the Mexican Revolution, but it was also American citizens that were targeted by this violence. And so somebody's American citizenship or their class or their status didn't protect them from violence. And so, but we don't remember this history because Texas and Texas cultural institutions and popular culture have actively told a history that erases this or disavows the violence of this and instead calls it justice. They call this a moment of Anglo superiority in being able to secure the border. And so this really does feed into these myths that we have that are troubling to confront. But, you know, when we have had these events in Texas, the museum exhibit opening in the Bullock, or these commemorations for the Texas State Historical Markers, hundreds of people attend. You know, over 40,000 people came to the Bullock Museum. Wow. And so Texans are ready to have this conversation. And for most people who do know this history, their family histories have been disavowed for over a century. And that's too long for somebody to have to wait for a public acknowledgement of a crime against humanity that they have lived with.
Monica, Michelle, let's take a quick break. This is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Cindy Rodriguez filling in for Brian. We're going to take a break and then we'll be back with journalist Michelle Garcia and Brown University professor Monica Munoz Martinez. Plus your calls. Stay with us. This is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Cindy Rodriguez, filling in for Brian. We're speaking with journalist Michelle Garcia and Brown University professor Monica Munoz Martinez. Michelle, I want to go back to you for a second. Your article is writing about the Texas-Mexico border. We are in New York City. This is a local New York City show. But there is also an inclusion of a New Yorker in your article, Walt Whitman. Can you tell me about this quote and where it came from?
Absolutely. I think there's this sense that New York is so far from the border and these perceptions and this lost history that we've been talking about, when in fact New York has played a very significant role, the whole East Coast has. When we look at the run-up to the U.S.-Mexico War, we had Walt Whitman publishing in the Brooklyn Eagle, calling Mexico burlesque, superstitious. I mean, his disdain for Mexico was well known. In fact, one of my ancestors wrote a book criticizing Walt Whitman and critiquing his work as being imperialistic, racist, and anti-Mexican. We also had in New York a fierce debate going on about what to do on the quote-unquote frontier, with Horace Greeley arguing that this notion of aggressive Mexico plunging the United States into war was a falsehood that has no life and no validity to it, and that this was really an attempt to expand slavery. But we all know that what Greeley called a falsehood became national mythology and shaped the perception of the border. And it's important to remember, too, that our understanding of citizenship, the frontier, Mexicans, Latinos, was being crafted as well by publishing, which, as we know, is centered in New York. And so beginning in the early days, you have military dispatches being published in New York magazines about their efforts to quell the frontier. And this is all shaping. It's forming a template and a paradigm through which we as journalists, it shapes and informs the way we as journalists report on and perceive violence and what goes on the border. And in that same piece, I critique, I'm the former Texas correspondent for the Columbia Journalism Review, a Newsweek article that was out a few years ago called Hunting Humans, in which it was reported that ranchers in South Texas were laying traps, were chasing down migrants, were hunting them, referring to them as dogs. In what other place in this country, and with who, what other people, would that be acceptable and not provoke outrage? But somehow violence is expected almost on the U.S.-Mexico border and on the frontier, and this comes as a result of a constructed narrative. And when we ask, why don't we know about this history, the lynching and so forth that Monica was referring to, many of those investigations were locked up for 60 years in the archives, unstudied, until someone went and pulled them out. We have recently in Texas the finally, after a long struggle on behalf of activists, a ethnic studies. And even then, that was contentious because the Board of Education wanted to call it Ethnic Studies, an overview of Americans of Mexican descent rather than Mexican Americans. So even now, labels, definitions, and narratives form a very important part in perception and therefore policy.
So education can be highly politicized in Texas. We have a call from Evan in Brooklyn. Evan, are you there? Evan, are you still there? Sorry to keep you waiting. What's your comment?
So I wanted to make a comment. I grew up in Texas, and I'm descended from, you know, on my dad's side from Latinos who've lived there since before Texas was, since Texas was a Spanish colony. And, you know, my, you know, this has been a big part of my family's experience. My dad, you know, grew up in El Paso, and like my grandma used to, you know, go grocery shopping in Mexico. And, you know, he definitely felt like he had to leave El Paso because he was being discriminated against. And, but at the same time, like, I didn't really grow up, you know, I'm, you know, white passing for sure. And I didn't really grow up thinking of myself as Mexican. I didn't even really, like, see a difference between Latinos and, you know, white people growing up. I didn't see that. And, but I did know that there was a difference between us and Mexicans. You know, Mexicans were definitely those other people across the, you know, across the border. That they were the ones that, you know, didn't know how to speak English or whatever. And and I see that in my family today. You know, like now seeing the way you know, people are talking about or with what's going on now. Like a lot of, you know, I see people in my own family who definitely, you know, want to say, you know, we you know, those are not us. You know, we are not Mexicans, and they take a very strong line against immigrants. And I've seen, you know, headlines about Latinos in Texas who, you know, don't, who are, you know, anti-immigrant or Trump supporters. And I guess that's, you know, as if it were a surprising thing. And to me, it's, you know, part of the fabric, I guess, of that experience of, you know, both experiencing, I guess, the discrimination and also the kind of confusion about race and citizenship. And
Evan, thank you so much for that comment. That's really interesting. Monica, we have about a minute left. How do you respond to this idea of racism between Latinos themselves?
You know, that's a long history. We have a long history of that. But we also, he's also speaking to this larger assumption that Americans have that people who are trying to come into the United States today aren't doing the right way. And historians of immigration have actually shown that immigration restrictions create these patterns of undocumented migration. And historically, U.S. legislators have had to pass, have given amnesty to European immigrants and to Mexican immigrants in the past. And so there's this sense that, you know, amnesty now is a bad word. And amnesty is a part of our American history that has corrected these misguided immigration policies in the past.
Ladies, we have to leave it there. That's all the time we have. Monica Munoz Martinez is a professor of American and Ethnic Studies at Brown University. She's the founder of the organization Refusing to Forget and the author of the forthcoming book, The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas. Michelle Garcia is a journalist. She recently published the first in a series of three articles on the border for the Baffler magazine. Thanks to you both for joining us. I'm Cindy Rodriguez, urban affairs reporter at WNYC, filling in for Brian Lehrer.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.